We'll intervene whenever we decide it's in our national security interest to intervene. And if you don't like it, lump it.
The problem with America is not that we go around marauding around the world imposing ourselves. The problem with America in the last 10, 15 years, since the end of the Cold War, really in the last 60 years, is that we've been too slow to get involved.
I don't know how many Iraqi civilians were killed, but I can assure you that the number is the absolute minimal that it's possible in modern warfare.
Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists.
Now, that land over there is yours. You'll go back to it one day because your fight will prevail and you'll have your homes and your mosques back again because your cause is right and God is on your side.
Welcome to the Darkened Hour.
Welcome to another episode of the Darkened Hour. I'm your host, Adam Fitzgerald. With me today is a special guest. Robin Swan has co-authored three best-selling books, The 11th Day, The Pole Story of 9/11, and Osama Bin Laden, which was a finalist for the 2012 Pulitzer Prize for History and won the prestigious Gold Dagger for nonfiction. Swan contributes to Vanity Fair and has written for the Daily Telegraph, Salon, The Observer, The Daily Beast, MSNBC, The Irish Times, The Sunday Independent, The Island Independent, Defense News, and The National Journal. She and her husband, Anthony Summers, have both contributed a large number of articles for the Florida Bulldog under Dan Christensen regarding the 9/11 attacks and the CIA Saudi roles that played in the attacks themselves. Today, we're going to talk about how she and Summers began their careers, the motivation on writing the book, and her articles on Florida Bulldog and more. Robin, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having us, Adam.
So I want to keep it simple right off the bat. Let's introduce your career to the audience proper. What made you want to become a journalist in the first place?
Oh, God. To make a long story short, I had a sort of Me Too moment. I was in graduate school working at a liberal defense policy think tank at the end of the Soviet era. So I'm aging myself. And this defense policy think tank, all of us young researcher interns sat in the middle of the sort of bullpen with the senior officers sitting around us where they could call upon us as they needed us. And one day I made this mistake of stretching. And a man who was a retired colonel, army colonel, groaned behind me and said, "Oh, don't stretch," in a very lascivious voice to the colleague sitting next to him. And in those days, you didn't complain to HR. You went to the ladies' room and cried. And then you pulled yourself together and you went back to your chair and continued writing about the T-72 tank, which is what I was then doing. But after that, it was sort of a wake-up call that I wasn't necessarily in the right place. And I talked to a colleague there, the only other woman in this defense policy think tank. And, you know, she said, "Well, you know, have you thought about journalism?" And I was sort of leaping from the frying pan into the fire. If I was worried about going into a man's world, because it was definitely writing about politics and national security and all that kind of thing in 1989 as a woman was still a pretty new thing. But I went from that defense think tank to the English newspaper, The Independent, and never looked back. I liked being on that side of the phone rather than being sitting around waiting for someone to call me.
It's almost as if you had a very rapid career, because here you are, you wrote two books, but they were biographies, one on Richard Nixon, the other on Frank Sinatra. And your third book, The 11th Day, The Full Story of 9/11, Osama Bin Laden, which was actually released on the anniversary of the attacks in 2011. And I remember specifically the first book I've ever read regarding 9/11, and this was Paul Thompson's Terror Timeline. And your book came next after that, which was really revealing in itself. And this was actually your third published text. And so you made quite the leap here. You went from biography to one of the most expansive and most just incredibly tedious projects, in my opinion anyway, which is the attacks of September 11th. Why did you and Anthony delve into this subject?
Well, when I began, Anthony hired me to work as his researcher on a biography of J. Edgar Hoover in 1988. And Anthony had already built a reputation as the man to call on to tackle the big story, whether that was the big story of the Kennedy assassination, the big story of the death of Marilyn Monroe, the big story of the Profumo scandal, the big story of the Russian imperial family's disappearance, the big story of Richard Nixon, whatever it was, Summers was supposed to be the man to tackle it. And I sort of got carried along with that as the younger partner in that relationship. And, you know, we finished our Hoover book, in which we famously put J. Edgar Hoover in a dress and came away without egg on our face. And then we together did Richard Nixon, a book I'm extremely proud of, but it's sort of, we're making a divergence between biography and the sort of 9/11 style book we did. But, you know, to do Richard Nixon is to do Watergate. It's to do lots of election stuff. It's to do organized crime. It's to do a big world of the CIA. You're doing a lot of the same topics. And, you know, even talking about doing a biography of Frank Sinatra, you're talking about the world of organized crime. A lot of the politics of the second half of the 20th century, Frank Sinatra was interwoven with that. So there was a natural sort of progression for us always to tackle the biggest subject that was out there and try to do it justice. And with the 11th day, we came out of our Frank Sinatra biography, and we were approaching the 10th anniversary. You know, it was sort of 6 or 7 years post 9/11. And it was the era in which Loose Change, the documentary that was out on YouTube, was really becoming the accepted wisdom of the 9/11 story. Things like Fahrenheit 9/11, the sort of very heavily propagandized view, the highly partisan view of what had happened on 9/11 was really taking hold. And we have always taken the position that we have to go in and start at square one in our investigation and really turn the subject upside down and shake it out and see what coins fall out of its pocket and see what we can find, what we can prove. And that's where we begin. And so 9/11 was that kind of story for us. You know, there was already, you know, so much myth and so much noise in that space. And we wanted to see what was real and what was fiction.
Right. And if I could follow up to that, because I have some experience with this, is that when I too watched Loose Change, and for a little bit, I accepted the narrative, like, say, no plane crash at Pentagon in Shanksville, because we'd never seen an intentional plane crash before of this magnitude. But when you look back and compare it to, say, PSA 717 or 71771 and German Wings 25, 9525, you look at the debris field and it's very small pieces of plane. You're not expected to see large engines or large pieces of fuselage because the planes were going at a high rate of speed and being fully loaded with kerosene. This actually divided the truth movement. I've had firsthand witness in dealing with people such of this nature. And so, like, if you were, say, the intelligence services and you wanted to cover up, say, the real conspiracy, which we're going to be talking a minute about, Al-Midar and Al-Hazmi and Saudi and CIA intelligence, well, what about this? Why don't we just let them publish the theories of no plane crash? If there's no plane crash, there's no hijackers. Was this something that you encountered earlier on, and did you find that to be a lot more deliberating in your studies as opposed to this, you know, as opposed to the official narrative as they claim that exists?
Well, I always try to shy away from large conspiracy theories. In other words, the conspiracy is so immense that, you know, that involves, you know, a cast of thousands, because, you know, that is a much harder conspiracy to keep a lid on. Carlos Marcello, the mafia don, famously said, two people can keep a secret if one of them is dead. And I tend to ascribe to that kind of theory. I do absolutely know what you mean when you say that the distraction of the early 9/11 truth movement, the talk about World Trade Center 7, the talk about there was no plane at the Pentagon, Flight 93, all of that kind of stuff was, if you wanted to use it as such, it was a very useful bit of noise to distract from asking other questions that were perhaps more pertinent to questioning the official narrative. And it was also interesting noise, and perhaps useful noise for at a time when lots of other things were going on in the American political landscape, you know, the Patriot Act, the curtailing of civil liberties, the Iraq War, the torture of prisoners. There was a lot going on in that political space that, you know, it all kind of fed together, and fed on itself. And I think, you know, where we are today in the United States with a lot of this conspiracy thinking, it goes back to the same kind of ideas, you know, and it does serve the interests of various players to have Americans distracted by fighting amongst themselves about, you know, planes and towers and this and that, and not asking the deeper, more serious questions about what we didn't know and why we didn't know it.
Yeah, and look, this leads right into another question I have for you regarding the book, is that you did ask those questions early on, and that led me, specifically, influenced me to look at those questions as well with yourself and Anthony and Paul Thompson and Kevin Fenton early on, really drove me to do the same, to look at 9/11 like an investigation. As soon as you published the book, there was one critical reception. I wouldn't say it's critical, but I think it was basically at the time understood, but now it's more revealing. Toby Hamden would write a review at the Telegraph, and regarding his questioning of a claim that you made in the book that the CIA was working with Saudi intelligence to recruit two Al-Qaeda operatives as informants. And he said, from the best when I read the article, was that, and this was early in the week, was that there was no real evidence or information to back up this claim. But however, you fast forward to the present day, 2025, and now there's an abundance to show that what you wrote in the book was absolutely correct. It was that there was a covert black operation involving the CIA, Counterterrorism Center, and involving Saudi intelligence and members of the Saudi kingdom to try and get two known Al-Qaeda operatives in Khalid al-Mihdhar and Nawaf al-Hazmi as informants for Al-Qaeda. In fact, in 1999, the DCI, George Tenet, told Kofor Black, the head of the Counterterrorism Center, to come up with a plan in getting informants inside Al-Qaeda. And now you would feel a lot more vindicated regarding Hampton's questioning of this. And I don't, what would you say about that regarding Toby Hamden now?
Well, look, it's interesting. You have stated a case that lots of people are stating right now as fact. I still don't know that that is fact. It is certainly where there, that is what titillating bits of testimony, and it's only testimony and recollection and commentary, that's where it leads us. And there are gaps in the official record that raise question marks. The behavior in particular of members of Alex Station in not giving their FBI colleagues particular bits of information about the movements of Hazmi and Mithar into the United States is very, you know, is very telling, perhaps. There's a lot there. There's a lot to look at, but we haven't, I don't think we've proven that case yet. We have no one in the CIA on the record telling us, admitting any such thing. We have no one on the Saudi side actually admitting such a thing. We have lots of sort of little bits of smoke that are very suggestive that that might have been what was happening. And in a lot of ways, it's the most benign explanation for what happened with Hazmi and Mihdhar, that the CIA and Saudi intelligence might have been working together, thinking they had penetrated Al-Qaeda, and that they were able to track the plotters, and then it all went awry. Well, if they had been right and they had kept their hands on it and they had done that, well, nothing would have happened. And 50 years from now, we would have found out and they would have been heroes. But as things stand, if they were doing that and it unraveled the way it looks to have done, then one understands that perhaps there is an exercise in people covering their posteriors going on. And that happens often in intelligence operations. But we haven't proven that yet. You know, the work I've been doing for these years and years now is picking apart little bits of information that come to me and trying to assemble the puzzle and assemble the puzzle with real specificity, to assemble that puzzle with the testimony of those people involved and with the contemporary documents that are available, and not just sort of woolly hypothesizing, you know. And that's the work that Dan and I have been doing with the Bulldog, the wonderful public interest magazine that has been following this story year upon year since Anthony and I got Dan Christensen involved with our research back in 2011. And, you know, every time I get a new document out of one of the agencies, I'm often able to turn that document into an intriguing new window on what actually happened. I'll give you an example that's pertinent to what we're talking about. Back in 2000, at the turn of the millennium, there was a great state, as many of your viewers will know, a real heightened terrorist threat, the idea that something awful was going to happen at the millennium, not just the famous Y2K, the idea that all the computers in the world would go back to thinking it was 1899 or 19, was something like that, the turn of the old century, but also that there was a terrible threat of Islamic terrorism hanging over the United States, so much so that on the millennium night, all of the intelligence community celebrated that they had dodged this bullet. But in the aftermath, Richard Clark, who was then with the National Security Council, a very senior figure in the national security infrastructure, he compiled, with the cooperation of others, a thing called the Millennium After Action Review. And it was basically the idea that the U.S. had dodged a bullet, but it was only by sheer luck. And that review was I can't remember, I think 18 pages long now. It became part of the materials that were later submitted to the 9/11 Commission and the Joint Inquiry as evidence about the threat of Al-Qaeda and what the intelligence community was doing about it. That document remained secret until 2020, when, after more than a decade of applying for it under mandatory declassification review, I finally obtained a copy of it. And what that document made clear was that the CIA and the intelligence community were terribly concerned about two things at that point. They were terribly concerned about their over-reliance on America's foreign intelligence partners. That means the intelligence agencies of other countries, particularly in the Arab world, and their reliability and what they were being passed in terms of information and the quality of that information. And they were also terribly concerned about their inability to penetrate Al-Qaeda. And there was a need in the intelligence community and it was really being pushed to come up with creative solutions for getting someone inside Al-Qaeda, inside OBL's operation. And that is the word used. And if you look at that and you think about that, you think about what happened later, and you think that Richard Clark is perhaps the first person to ever articulate the idea that there might have been a joint U.S.-Saudi intelligence operation that went wrong. And then you think to the fact that the president's national security advisor at that time, a man named Sandy Berger, derailed his entire career by going into the National Archives and attempting to steal every single existing copy of the Millennium After Action Review and hiding them in his socks and getting caught. And you begin to try to pick through what does all that mean. Now, it puts you in a world of supposition, which is exactly what I don't like to be in. I like to be in a world of facts, but it is deeply puzzling that this report, this 18 pages, would be of such interest and of such concern to the National Security Advisor, that he would want to steal it. Did one of those copies perhaps have something scribbled on it that he thought would be incriminating of what one of these attempts to infiltrate Al-Qaeda might be? Did perhaps one of those bits of paper perhaps refer to which foreign intelligence partners that the Americans were particularly concerned about? The truth is, we don't know, because Sandy Berger took five copies of them. We don't know if there were any copies that he took that weren't returned. The National Archives investigation is rather incomplete. This all happened after Berger had testified to the 9/11 Commission, and he was never recalled to the commission to account for his behavior. So, you know, these are the kinds of peculiar circumstances that exist when one is looking at the trail of evidence about 9/11. And that's just one small example.
Right. That's one small example is right. Would it be too damning? Let me follow up on that. If it'd be too damning to say, because I would think this would be, for me anyway, would be too much, I guess, irresponsible, because there is no direct, you know, evidence to suggest that just maybe the CIA had specific information about the attacks happening and maybe kept it away from State Department officials or the FBI. But I have never made that assumption, although some people in the Truman would like to say, would that be, is that too irresponsible or too bold, or is that a reasonable theory?
Adam, I have to tell you, I have never seen any evidence to support that.
Right.
I haven't seen, you know, and therefore I would never suggest such a thing.
Right. Right.
I think one of the mistakes that can often creep into any, you know, you and I are having a conversation and your listeners, you know, are going to be out there and they're going to have varying degrees of expertise in this subject area. And what they will know is that people have strong feelings about this, and they have strong feelings about the behavior of America's intelligence agencies. And it's, I think, important to remember, because I've worked in this field for many, many years, and I've encountered thousands of FBI and CIA and government officials over the course of my career. And by and large, these are decent, patriotic, hardworking Americans with all the same flaws that you and I have. And they are not, by and large, conspiracy, they're not evildoers. Sure, in every group of people, there are going to be those who are motivated by things we don't necessarily approve of or understand. But I always hesitate to make sweeping accusations about the CIA or the FBI or the government, because all of those things are made up of individuals who are just like you and me.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think this is what many people don't realize is that by making these accusations, it actually destroys the reputation within. It's, you just can't trust that person anymore. But, you published an article just last September, and it was regarding a number of key Saudi Arabian intelligence officials, which pushed the 9/11 Commission's top staff, including its executive director, Philip Zelikow, to exonerate a key Saudi suspect and the guy who's central to the story, Omar al-Bayoumi. And you wrote that the meeting was held at the Conference Palace in the Saudi capital, Riyadh, with FBI legal attaches. Would you say, was this the beginning of the initial cover-up between Saudi Arabia and the Bush White House that still exists today?
Again, I would draw back from saying that there was a conspiracy and cover up that existed between those two entities, because I haven't got the evidence to support that the Bush White House and the Saudi government colluded in that way. I would certainly think that there were elements within both of those things. Elements certainly within the Saudi regime that were covering up and attempting to steer the way the discourse unwound, and there were certainly I think there was a certainly a reticence within the United States within certain members of the U.S. government to look too closely at the Saudis. I think there was. From the very beginning, there was an acknowledged problem between the fact that there are members of the Saudi royal family and the Saudi regime who appear to be very pro-Western, pro-US, and there are others historically who have not been. And it's hard sometimes to differentiate between the two. But even the closest Saudis to the US, i.e., Prince Bandar, Prince Bandar has himself always admitted that no matter how close he is to the US, he plays for the home team. And the home team in his case is Saudi Arabia. And his concerns are not necessarily those of those that are in the best interests of the United States or the people of the United States. So, in all the research I have been doing, I've been trying to isolate the bad actors from those who perhaps were themselves misled or those who were involved in intelligence gathering activities that may have gone wrong. And those individuals aren't just Americans. Those are Saudis. They are, they are Yemenis. They are perhaps, others. And I haven't come up with a great sort of swinging theory that covers every base of 9/11 and that solves every question I have. In all this work, I keep coming to little bits of further information that tends to support the existence of a support network for those hijackers closely linked to members of the Saudi government and to certain members of the Saudi royal family. But that isn't in itself saying the Saudi government did it. There is a line between those two things. And, you know, if we posit that Saudi intelligence was working with U.S. intelligence, i.e. the Saudi GID and the CIA, and if we were saying that Prince Bandar was the person who was sort of paymaster for that operation within the United States, thinking he was running Bayoumi, just hypothetically, well, does that make Prince Bandar a bad actor, or does that make him a good actor who is mistaken? And you know, one is teasing these things out, and hopefully, in the long course of all of this research, one will come to a point where we have some more definitive answers. But that is what I'm, you know, I'm constantly working at, you know, cutting, trying to get, you know, make my way through the long grass here. You know, another thing that I've had released, I've managed to get to the 9/11 commission interviews of both Prince Bandar and Prince Turki. Yes. And you will, your readers will, your listeners will find this interesting and perhaps horribly amusing in a way. When I was writing about 9/11 a decade ago, of course, Prince Bandar, the long-running U.S. ambassador, a Saudi ambassador to the United States, known in the world as Bandar Bush because he was so close to the Bush family. His cousin, Prince Turki, bin Faisal, the long-running head of Saudi intelligence. These were two very, very key players in the Saudis' relationship with Al Qaeda and the Saudis' attempts to control and interdict Al Qaeda. And yet, when the 9/11 Commission interviewed them, they did so in secret, and their interviews were kept absolutely secret. And I applied for them under a mandatory declassification review. And when I applied for that, the one belonging to Prince Turki, I was given a thing called the Glomar response, which is a response in which the National Archive says to you, we cannot confirm or deny that such a document exists, which is a degree, a measure of how sensitive it was considered to be. And yet, when I finally did get a hold of both documents, what they essentially showed was the 9/11 Commission completely and woefully failing to ask either of these two men any of the really obvious questions that were swirling around their involvement in 9/11 way back in 2004. You know, there were big question marks over the behavior of Prince Bandar and over the behavior of Prince Turki that were well known. And yet the 9/11 Commission staff didn't go in and ask them. Well, what was that about?
Yeah, I would say, just to go along with you here, being careful is one thing. Like, for example, with Saudi Arabia, there are anywhere between approximately 5,000 to 15,000 members of the Saudi royal family. The definitive number is not known to anyone. Would there be, say, elements within that community that are sympathetic to bin Laden's cause? Yes. Does that mean that King Fahd or the crown prince and or anybody in the family, whether it be King Salman, King Fahd, whatever, King Khalid, would they know about it? No, of course, it's all, if we're going to play that conspiracy for, it's a need to know basis. But they probably had no idea whatsoever at all. Do you really want a public figure to know about an intricate detail that might harm an ally? And of course not. In that case, but you know, it is. I agree with you here, because after scouring thousands of documents and files and number of books over the years, I've led to more questions than answers, of course, unfortunately, just like you, in the case that it's okay to speculate reasonably, but it's one thing to not use speculation as a form of evidence, which is what so many people have done over the years. You know, the thing about Omar Abiyumi, and you wrote about him prominently, and he's like central to almost every conspiracy involved that we talk about. And you wrote about him prominently in your latest articles, no less, in the last 2 years. One of them was that the San Diego FBI and the United Kingdom's authorities, Scotland Yard, were not made aware about critical evidence seized at Bayoumi's residence in Birmingham, England, where he fled right before right after the attacks, that one of the pieces of evidence that was found, and I didn't know until I read your article, which was a bombshell, and I remember making a video about that article that you guys were behind, and to me I couldn't believe it. It was a notebook that was found with actual airline coordinates and a video of himself in front of the nation's capital that was filmed in 1999, in which 60 Minutes even did an episode on. And here, you know, and in the film, by the way, are two individuals that, again, came from your articles. It was like, which was stunning to me. It was through the Operation Encore files that you guys filed the Freedom of Information. I think your biggest revelation of all was that was getting to those files. But was Adel al-Sadan and Mutia Balsideri, which were emissaries to an individual who I'm going to talk about next. And this was not known to the FBI until recently. Why would they hide this connection from the Department of Justice and from authorities abroad?
Well, this is a real head scratcher. The chain of evidence after 9/11, you had FBI agents and a member of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, as far as I can tell, who went to London to work with their English counterparts from the English Counterterrorism Force. When they picked up Bayoumi, they had a certain amount of time under which they could question him. They questioned him very seriously. The guys from the yard were very good, and they were clearly exchanging information extensively. You know, they knew where he'd been living. They knew the hijackers had been living next to him. They knew that he had assisted the hijackers in getting that rental. They knew, you know, they had clearly been sharing information back and forth, and they had swept up in his apartment this bag. I think it was three bags of videotapes. They were sitting there showing them to Bayoumi. Is it this one? Is it that one? They want him to look at, you know, they want to have a look at something that's known in our sort of world as the welcome party, a dinner party in Bayoumi's home that was actually held partially in Bayoumi's house and partially in Al-Hazmi and Al-Midar's apartment. At which many figures who would appear to be a part of this support network appear. And Hazmi and Midar are very briefly in this video. And so they're asking him all about this stuff. And yet all of this material that has been confiscated from Bayoumi's apartment, including, as you mentioned, this notebook that has an algebraic equation for targeting a plane to a horizon, which Bayoumi gives a completely, you know, half-assed explanation for, an incomprehensible explanation. But it never makes its way to the Pent Bomb team in the U.S. who are studying this. It's buried away in an FBI warehouse and not excavated for many, many years. And then some of it is never unearthed until lawyers for the 9/11 victims and families apply directly to the Metropolitan Police in the UK, and in 2022 are given this stuff. So, you know, anyone who says we know the full story of 9/11 and it was all there in the 9/11 Commission report doesn't know what they're talking about, because there is material that was never seen by anyone that is critical to understanding the support for the hijackers within the United States. And that part of the investigation, at least, we do not know everything about.
No, we don't. But even with all the years of study, like I'm left away with more, like I said, with more questions than answers. But you guys were behind probably one of the biggest breakthroughs in regarding 9/11, and that was your Freedom of Information Act of the Operation Encore Files. And it was disclosed to you guys in December of 2016, documents regarding the litigation case involved. Now, years later, in 2020, when the files were finally released to the public from former President Joe Biden's Executive Order 14040, which revealed a lot more, because when you got the documents, it was heavily redacted. Even though these pages are certainly redacted, but they showed a little bit more. And it was interesting because there was one page that failed to redact a name. And this was a name that was known to the FBI for many years. And that was Mursad Ahmed Al-Jarr, who was the head or the director of Islamic Affairs at Saudi Arabia's Washington, D.C. embassy. Now, this name was a true revelation, not only for 9/11 victims' families currently suing the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia at the Southern District of New York, but to anyone involved in the case, including me and you, and because this single man would become the overseer of the operatives that were involved with Khalid al-Maidar and Nawaf al-Hazmi inside the United States, and involved with Omar al-Bayoumi, Fahad al-Tamari, and Osama Basnan, by using two Saudi officials that were in the video itself, in Mutia al-Sadari and Adel al-Sadan, who you mentioned in a number of your articles. Did you have any idea by publishing this in 2016 that it would become as big as it did at the time? Was this this had to have been a huge story for you?
Well, look, I have to give credit here to Dan Christensen. Dan Christensen at the Bulldog. We brought Dan into the story to work with us on revelations we had uncovered about the possible existence of a support cell for the hijackers in Florida, in Sarasota. And that work, which was really quite, which was groundbreaking and critically important, re-energized Senator Graham, Senator Bob Graham, who, you know, an American hero, really, who was so affronted by the stonewalling of the FBI in regard to our Sarasota investigation, that he was, you know, really moved to push in the final years of his life to really push for the release of the 28 pages. And so I'm hugely proud that, you know, we had a small part in all of that. And in the course of that effort and in our subsequent Freedom of Information Act filings, we got this snippet. And Dan, I have to say, I was working on a book about Pearl Harbor at the time, so was not as focused, as laser focused as Dan was on this document. But Dan uncovered it, and when he brought it to our attention, we were all really, we were gobsmacked to know that the extent of the FBI's ongoing, continuing work, and that, you know, all the things that would be revealed about that Operation Encore subsequently, the, you know, the divergence within the FBI about the importance of the material they were uncovering, disagreements about whether or not it was supportive of the idea of a support network, you know, stymieing by headquarters, all of that stuff that we now know from our reporting only became possible because Dan Christensen and the Bulldog went to the mat to time after time repeat that FOIA request, and you know that's what this kind of work takes. You know, it takes time, it takes energy, you know, repeated filings, appeals, etc. And sometimes then you get that wonderful reveal.
Yeah, it was huge in its nature because we had very important questions regarding Fayoumi and Father Thomarion, and some of those revelations certainly answered those questions and putting the puzzle together. There was, you know, just to add a little bit of a follow up to that, it was shortly thereafter you published another story which I was like blown away by. I remember, and it was an article you published last year, September, I want to say September, it was September 12th, 13th. No, I was like, I think it was September 12th, 13th, or 14th. And for me, this was a very explosive article because it covered an FBI top confidential informant, and his name is Dr. Abdusattar Sheikh. And why is he important? Because he actually shared rooms in his house with two future 9/11 hijackers, Khalid Al-Badr and Nawaf al-Hazmi, who, in your article, which was unknown to me and others like me, have been co-opted by none other than Omar Al-Bayoumi. And this came from evidence which surfaced in federal court in New York in a long-running civil suit case with the victim's family's lawyers. And this had not been divulged before. And Sheikh himself, for years, denied ever meeting Al-Bayoumi. Now, this is really big because it shows that there is a connection between this operation by it seems, Mursad al-Jara, involving Omar al-Bayoumi, the Imam of the King Fahd Mosque, Fahd al-Thamari, and now Dr. Abdusattar Sheikh, and this ties closer to al-Midar and al-Hazmi. Just speak a little bit more about that. I mean, first of all, I don't know. I tried to look it up. Is Dr. Sheikh still alive? Are you aware
no,
of that?
No, no.
Best way.
No, Dr. Sheikh has died. I got that confirmed by one of his sons. So unfortunately, he will remain a mystery figure in the 9/11 story. After the 9/11 attacks, access to Dr. Sheikh was very heavily controlled by the FBI. The FBI had been running him as an informant, codename Muppet. Possibly very appropriate. Maybe the FBI agent should have been called Muppet, but anyway, the new evidence was that he had also been co-opted by Saudi intelligence. He, you know, he was an elderly man of Indian extraction, known to be doing good works in the community, interested in promoting dialogue, interfaith dialogue, known for taking in young men to his house after his divorce. He needed income, but not charging the hijackers. He remains an intriguing figure. And I pieced together the long piece I did on him last year, relies heavily on his own witness statements to the FBI, which anyone can read on the Bulldog website. It is intriguing. One of the things that I found interesting is that after 9/11, he revealed in one of his interviews that Hazmi had been visited by a man who was very hot, very wealthy, and a key donor to the Holy Land Foundation. Now, this is a man whose name had never come up before,
Hmm.
and would seem to put Hazmi in the orbit of people raising money for the likes of Hamas. Now, why would Hazmi, a young Saudi, have had any reason to know such an individual? And if he didn't know him, why did Dr. Shape decide suddenly that this was a name he should present to his FBI handlers? So again, it's a question within a question. A question we'll never see the resolution to because Dr. Shake is now dead. But there are still stories to be picked at here. There's still information to be revealed, and there is still information in FBI files that hasn't been properly analyzed.
As we begin to wrap it up here, Robin, do you think from this point forward that we will see any type of trial? Now, we from the five, we now have only Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Tawfiq bin Attash Khalad, and Mustafa al-Sawi. Ramzi bin al-Shib was declared mentally unfit. And Omar al-Baluchi, I just interviewed one of his co-counsel in regards to his mental health as well. His testimony is inadmissible because of torture. Alka Pradhan, one of his co-counsel. Do you have any hope whatsoever in regarding a trial ever coming to surface? If not, what do you think will happen from here?
This is a terrible question, and it's a terrible question because it's a terrible it's a because it it's a terrible indictment of the US justice system in the post 9/11 world, that people accused of such a heinous crime, and the deaths of thousands of Americans, may never see trial. Because I do think that the issue of torture taints the entire process, that I'm not sure that it can ever happen. And I do know from my contact with survivors that they are beside themselves with the continuing slow walk of this process. In the course of the last 6 months, I've seen again. The survivors I know get letters saying, "We're very sorry to tell you that the dates for interviews are going to be rescheduled, and the dates for courts are going to be rescheduled, and these days are being canceled, and those days are being canceled, and this days are being rescheduled," and it's just a grinding process. And meanwhile, people who have not been convicted of crimes are and who have been tortured at the hands of our forces are sitting in Guantanamo endlessly, and that isn't the way it's supposed to work. And I don't see a positive resolution. Those men are aging. They're all 25 years older than they were. Some of them are not in particularly good health. And certainly they're not in good mental health. And I it just it, it I don't foresee a time when it's going to be possible to try them in a US court.
I spoke to somebody that you're quite familiar with, Ken Jennings of Phoenix. I asked him once, and during our interview, was that I said what he thought about regarding a trial. He said that there won't be one, and he happens to think that what will happen is that they'll take the death penalty off the table in order for them to plead guilty all across the board. And what will happen is two things. One will be that they'll serve out the remainder of their time at Guantanamo, or they'll be dispatched to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia or to Gulf Partners and serving out their sentence. I think the more
To the king
glaring, I think the more glaring,
of Saudi Arabia.
I'm sorry, the more glaring worry for me is that we will never know if there's no trial, if they plead out. There won't, we will not know what the government had or what they did have, because what they did have is going to be classified for the next 25, 30 years. And that, again, it'll lead right back to more questions and answers. And I think, I'll echo your statement. This will be a damning indictment on the country itself and how we handled it. All right, what projects are you working on now? Are you tell the audience what you're working on now, what you're working in the future.
I'm doing a combination of, I'm doing a whole bunch of different things, which is why, and I apologize to your audience if I seem a little bit scatty and less focused on the particulars of 9/11 than I should be. I am working on a three-part documentary series about the hunt for Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. I'm also extremely preoccupied doing a book slash film about the theft of, potentially by the Irish Republican Army, the Provisional IRA, by a famous Irish racehorse called Shergar. I'm also working on a story. I'm working on some stuff about the myth of the POW, the myth of the POW, and how that intersects with the rise of the MAGA movement. So I'm doing a whole number of different very intensive investigations and working on too many things at once.
Yeah, way you have a lot to go on there. But you listen, Robin, I could tell you from myself and the guys I tend to circle with, which is very small. We're a small group of 9/11 researchers and filmmakers. Nelson Martins, who is a prominent 9/11 filmmaker, Sean Russell, Darren Harvey, and Leonardo Salvaggio. There aren't many of us, but there are some of us. And, we owe you and Dan and Anthony a great indebted of thank you, because I always sing the praises of Florida Bulletin because they are the preeminent publication when it comes to new information regarding 9/11. And there isn't much out there to begin with. You're for us, you're the Paul Thompson of the current era. And I just want to say thank you on behalf of all of us. And, and thank you very much for coming on to the show today. Really, I appreciate it very much.
It's absolutely my pleasure, and I want to give a shout out, not just to Dan, but there are a couple of other people. I think you'd also say that Mike Isikoff,
Oh,
and
yes.
Mike Kelly of the Bergen Record. There are very
Yes.
few other journalists who are working this story, and I think all of us who are working this story see its importance, its continuing importance, and trying to get it right. And so, yeah, we really welcome your continued reading of the material, and that you're there in the trenches supporting the work we're all trying to do.
Robin Swan, author of The 11th Day and analyst over at Florida Bulldog. Thank you very much for tuning in. Thank you again, Robin.
My pleasure. Take care, Adam.